Our next presenter, Sky Wills.
Hi, I'm Sky Wills. I'm with NRCS at the National Soil Survey Center, and I'm going to pivot just a little bit from soil research to sort of the fringes of soil research, where we try to take this, the things that we know and give them to practitioners. And so I'm going to talk about a tool that uses some sample design knowledge to help them better plan their projects. So sample size requirements, as you know, are established to ensure that you can do what you want to do, do what you set out to do and accomplish it. And the project objective could be to detect a change in property over time. It could be to detect a difference. It could be to characterize something sufficiently. And that's something we worry about a lot in soil survey. We want to know what a certain property is in a given area. That might be how we set it up. So sample size requirements are important, and people think about them, but they don't often take them into account when they're doing their project planning. So the sample size requirements, as we've gone through, and I don't need to go through the details, but it depends on the minimum detectable difference. What difference do we need to see to think that something is different? The variance, and I'm going to talk about multi-scale variance, so both a within-plot or residual variance and also a between-plot or landscape-scale variance. And then, of course, things like error and precision rates, alpha and power, which can be modified by any correlation that occurs with multiple sampling. So for our multi-scale sampling requirements, the number of samples needed to detect change the plot scale standard, power analysis, very simple Z distribution. We just took into account two different scales of variability, which isn't always done. So when I present this to practitioners, we simplify this down to the bare nuts. They just want to know, what do I need to know? N, how many samples, the variance, and what's my minimum detectable difference? And I present this to them as this can be, you can solve this either way. It depends on what are you interested in doing. Do you have a certain number of samples and you want to know what you're able to detect, or would you like to go the other way? And so we've separated this into actual versus desired minimum detectable difference. So the actual would be what you can do with what you've already sampled. You might do this post hoc, or you might just be constrained by how many growth chambers you have or something like that. And so then we just rearrange the equation and solve for that. Or there might be a desired minimum detectable difference. You know what the functionally important difference is to you, but you're willing to sample whatever you need to sample in order to accomplish that. So minimum detectable differences present something of a problem, because ideally we would like to do something that's functionally important. Something that's meaningful either economically or functionally on an ecosystem service scale, but a lot of the time we don't have any idea what that is. We don't know whether a 5% change in organic carbon is important or not. We, you know, just because we can detect it doesn't mean it's meaningful. So often we will set the minimum detectable difference to a percentage of the mean, say 5 or maybe up to 50, not very often. But one way, in this case study I'm going to present today, what we've done is set up a set of parameters, assuming a landowner is interested in a contract with the Climate Exchange Commission. And this is a common area of interest in semi-arid rangelands. They're difficult to manage. The price of cattle fluctuates. If they can perhaps stock less cattle, manage their rangeland a little differently, and get a carbon benefit from that, landowners are often willing to do that. And so we can set those limits on what a typical, well, in this case, the Chicago Climate Exchange, what their typical contract might be. Then we could say, okay, if we were to go out and as part of the research support for these landowners, the ARS station is interested in saying we can or cannot measure that. Now, it's typically not really measured. Usually it's modeled, but from a research perspective, someone might be interested in it. So we developed this multi-scale sampling requirement evaluation tool. We had the statistician. I'm not the statistician in the group, but the statistician in the group developed the equations, and then I put them into an Excel form, and then another of my collaborators, Jason Carl, put them onto a nice, nifty website. And the tool will report either the number of samples needed to detect the change at either the plot or landscape scale, or it can tell you what your minimum detectable difference is with your project is already sampled. And if you're interested in this tool or sharing it with someone, I have handouts at the NRCS booth that you can pick up. Just a little plug. So the case study is, it was specifically collected for testing monitoring techniques on rangelands. And it involves four ecological sites in southern New Mexico. So ecological sites are a type of land with a specific characteristic vegetation and amount of vegetation that responds in a distinct way to disturbance. So it's essentially a soil interpretation, and it typically groups similar soil series. So it's a way of grouping map units and soil series into bigger management scale polygons and things we can apply on the landscape. So there are four of those in southern New Mexico that they sampled. Two conditions, degraded and undegraded, and basically there's a reference state for these ecological sites. They know what they think it should look like, and an expert in the vegetation of the area has gone out and said, yes, it meets it, or no, it's degraded and needs work, usually. Three plots for each of these ecological site condition combinations were sampled, and the plots were about a hectare in size with 18 soil samples per plot. Now, a 1 hectare size plot sounds really big, especially if you're used to agronomic studies. However, this is a semi-arid rangeland where the vegetation is patchy, the soil properties are patchy. In order to link vegetative and soil properties together and to be able to say anything about the vegetation at all, the plots have to be that large. So we took 18 samples per plot and then analyzed them for a suite of properties, but today I'm going to look at bulk density, organic carbon combined into carbon stocks, because that gives us one thing and it gives us something that we can compare against that climate exchange number. So this is what the MESRET, we call it, multi-scale sample requirement tool, looks like on the web. It will walk you through estimating your multi-scale variance if it's a balanced design, estimated if it's not. Typically, we do some sort of mixed model to produce this, but you know, we're thinking of a practitioner that doesn't have those resources. They're going to a website, and they just want to be able to put the numbers in and get something out. So this is what we came up with for variance on these ecological sites. As you can see, almost all of the variances almost all of it is within plot. And that may be somewhat unusual in some situations, but it's fairly typical for these semi-arid rangelands because the variability, it's all right there, you know. And there is no spatial dependence. It's very, very, very patchy. So I'm going to focus on two ecological sites and conditions that represent the highest and lowest amount of carbon stocks. So a sandy degraded condition and a shallow sandy undegraded. And they have varying degrees of variance. So for the sandy degraded site, you can see that the website lets you put in an overall mean and you're within plot variance. Then it's going to show you the minimum detectable difference is a percent of mean and translate that to an absolute value and shows you the number of samples per plot versus the number of plots you would need to collect. And this allows a practitioner to go in and just get a visual representation of what they're up against, to speak. So, that was supposed to come up with box. Oh, there we go. So this translates into the lowest value for that climate exchange. So over 5 years at the rate for CO2, that translates to approximately 0.4 megagrams per hectare over the 5 years that you would have to change. So if I wanted to go out to this ecological site and condition again and remeasure, and all I could expect was that amount of change, how many samples would I need to take? And so unless you're taking quite a few samples per plot, and even then, it's a lot of plots. It's very variable. It's going to be difficult to detect. But in reality, it's probably much more, well, I shouldn't say it's much more, but you would hope that you would be at the upper edge of that area. You would be at the 1.75 megagrams per hectare, the upper end of what the climate exchange would give you, and then you don't need anywhere near as many plots to detect. Now the issue becomes, as we're evaluating this, is which end of that are you going to fall on and what's reasonable? And the fact is, for these rangelands, it's probably the lower number that's reasonable. You're not going to get a lot of carbon accumulation over time. They just don't move that fast. So the other portion of this is a post-project sampling sufficiency, in which you can put in your overall mean, variance at each scale, and then the desired minimum detectable difference. So I've put that 1.75 megagrams per hectare that the climate exchange wants in here. And it can tell me how many samples or plots I need to collect in order to say something about that. And the issue here is that at a plot scale, you would really need quite a lot of samples per plot, more than is really feasible. And changing that to 0.4, my box is a little off, it's going to be almost impossible for us to collect enough data to ever detect that small of a change in these systems. So I'm just going to brush through the other ecological site, but you can see the differences somewhat in that the mean is higher, but the variance is also higher, which means that we don't even make it to that 0.4 in order to, it would have to change 5 or 10% of what's already there before we have any hope of capturing it with our sampling scheme. So even at 25 samples per plot, we would be up around 9 plots, which may be doable, but it's not easy. Let's just put it that way. And if we change that to the 0.4, we're 544 plots. That's not feasible at all. And so I will, as I flip through these, I'll make a statement about varying the number of samples per plot and plots is important for land managers. And these are people who, I mean, they may have some scientific training. They're often rangeland specialists, biologists, but they're not necessarily soil scientists or statisticians. They're managing the land. They have knowledge, but they don't have high-tech equipment to deal with. But for them, they're going to pretty remote locations. So if they can take a bunch of samples in one plot and fewer plots, that's a great cost savings to them. On the other hand, if it doesn't do them any good to take a lot of samples per plot, they don't need to be disturbing the site any more than they have to. So this is a balancing act that they're looking at whenever they go through this process. So I left a little part out of what I presented, and that was what are the alpha power and, well, rho. And you might think this scandalous, but my alpha is 0.8, well, 0.2, power is 0.8, excuse me. And it's this is a big research question for the soil survey in general, in that we're never going to get to the 0.95. We're definitely not going to get to 0.99. That's just not going to happen. We're never going to get there. But even 0.8, we have a poster, Phil Schoenberger has a poster tomorrow on saturated hydraulic conductivity, and we're looking at 0.7 because we think that's the best we're ever going to get. And so when we apply these studies, you know, we move beyond small-scale research where you can really tightly control and you can really target your blocks to where there is little variability as possible. When we move beyond that to landscape-scale practitioners, then those alphas are not really, we just can't do it. It's not possible. So I will point out that rho is altering this through, it's the correlation between measurements. So if we were to measure through time, that would be the amount of correlation we expected between measurements. So we set it to 0.5 as an illustration of the fact that increasing that brings that nasty, well, I think this was the one that was like 39. It halved it to 15. So that's much more reasonable. So that tells you that if the land manager, if we're going to monitor for these things, they would have to be careful marking where they sampled and go back and increase the rho as much as possible. So the number of plots needed, if we did 18 samples in each plot, which is what we did originally, would range anywhere from, well, for the 0.4, it would range anywhere from 18 to 519 plots, which does not seem very possible, whereas 1.75 it's pretty reasonable. The issue would be the time. How long will it take to get to that 1.75 megagrams per hectare? And that should probably be considered in the balance of land managers thinking, what can I actually measure, what's actually possible, and how long should my contract be for? So just to summarize, the MESRET tool allows for project planning and assessment. It evaluates multi-scale variance and leads you through the process of thinking about minimum detectable difference and the sampling requirements for those rangeland carbon stock accounting. It varied by ecological site and condition, which can also tell us something about inference space of our projects, what we're really interested in, and perhaps limiting it to one ecological site might get us more bang for our buck. It that way. So with that, I'll take any questions. Yes?
Can I ask about the support, the base sample support? Is it a single core?
The support is a single core.
So with so much within plot variation, I mean almost all your variance
yes. Plot,
if you were to aggregate plot cores from across such a plot.
Right, and make the support the plot.
That could have quite a dramatic
effect. And in fact, when we go, it could. And we have thought about doing it that way. And for analysis costs, if you composite it, make the support the plot size. We haven't done that yet for this study because it was originally gathered with the intention of linking those patches together, the patches of vegetation to the soil properties. Yes, that's a very good idea.
But it wouldn't just be your analytical costs. It would be the fact that so much of that variance was actually...
Yeah, and you pooled it, and essentially you got the real mean without... Yeah. Yes?
Have you told your sample size for one plot versus 30 plots almost the same, very close? By then is the program assumed...
There was one... The...
The
total sample size.
For one plot,
yes.
The sample size is over 800. Sample size.
Yeah.
If you choose 30 plots, it's about 25 sample plots.
That's a good point. I should look at that. That may not be... I hadn't looked at it when I had put it into the tool, and I should look and see if that's, because you're right, because that should be counted in the replication, and I don't think, maybe it's not. I think it's not counting that replication correctly. That's a good point. I'll look into that, because I, yeah.
Yeah, I you can see sort of the challenges you're facing when you look at this picture over here.
Yeah.
But, one issue, I missed it maybe, but we discussed earlier, the sample should be independent, shouldn't it? So, you should have sort of a random sampling of your...
They are random. The points within the plot are there. Well, they are, they're randomly, it's a random number generator on an XY grid. So
the samplers that go out, they know exactly where to take it?
Essentially, the center of the plot was... geospatial, you know, an XY coordinate, and then from that they laid out an XY grid and random generated the X and Y coordinates.
Any other questions? I have one
question.
Sure. In terms of the users of this tool, how much statistical background or training you think they should have in order to use it in more or less meaningful fashion? I mean, I understand they can kind of click the buttons, but to do this in a meaningful way, what minimal training they would need to have?
Well, we are putting together a user guide that's it's fairly simple, but I think you would at least need to read that. I mean, you need some basic understanding of the question and some basic understanding of the fact that variance exists, even if you don't know it's called variance. You need that concept, and that's, you know, not everybody knows that. So, I mean, that's a difficult question. I'm not sure what the answer is. But we do assume that there's some amount of bringing up to speed that we have to do, and we would do that with the user guide. Part of it is just we would like them to use this tool, see that it can vary, and then get someone who knows a little more about it to help them. That would be the basics. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.